Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
All right. Hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Brantley Palmer. I'm joined, as always, by Lee Carlo and Jeremy Fisk. On this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast, we are going to be talking about the new film in theaters, Meek's Cutoff. We're going to follow that up with a discussion of survival films. And then we're going to transition into the theater-going experience. What's going wrong? What are theaters still doing right? And will theaters end up surviving in the future? And we are going to wrap everything up with our top five period piece films.
In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground. And now, lest he put forth his hand, and take also of the tree of life, and eat, and live forever.
Well, if it's riches you're after, there's riches aplenty. That's the truth. You mark my words.
We follow land downhill.
We need water. That much I know.
That's what you think? Are we lost?
I'd say that seems about the right word for it.
We're not lost. We're just finding our way.
I don't blame him for not knowing. I blame him for saying he did.
We made our decision. This is only a bad dream soon. It's going to be a story to tell.
It's a quick one.
He knows where the water is.
I've seen him strip the flesh clean off a man while he's still breathing.
You people got no idea what you are dealing with here.
We caught him signaling to someone. It means something.
Open your eyes. God knows where he's taking us.
Is he ignorant or is he just plain evil?
Who knows what's over that hill? Could be water. Could be an army of heathen.
All right, guys. So this week we went to see Meek's Cutoff, which is the new film from Kelly Ricard, who directed Wendy and Lucy. And she teams up again with Michelle Williams in this film. My question to you guys, was this film worth the price of admission at the theater for you guys?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I enjoyed the film, actually. It took me a little bit to get into it. But one thing that actually came into my mind, Brantley, was a question for you about this movie, because you mentioned that when you saw True Grit, that it was the most feminist Western you had ever seen. Do you still stand by that, or do you think Meek's Cutoff took the cake for that?
Yeah, no, I would still stand by that. I mean, True Grit's up there, and I think a film like 40 Guns is another one that's right up there in terms of feminist Westerns. Meek's Cutoff, I don't know if I would necessarily call it so much a feminist Western.
Oh, because it definitely is. It's eyes of the females, especially Michelle.
But what power does she have throughout the movie? I mean,
there is no power.
Feminist,
that's the thing. I mean, that's what they're showing you.
For me, though, that's what's going to make a feminist Western is are the female characters in it the ones who actually have
she ends
most
up
of the power.
Giving. I mean, she ends up taking that power, and that was the great thing about this movie. I mean, it showed how sort of powerless these women were to the men, to the scenario they were in, to the environment they were in, and Michelle Williams slowly but surely ends up taking over that control. In a time and a place that seems unheard of.
Does she, though? I mean, I don't think she takes over any power over the men in the group. The men.
Really? I mean, she's the one who keeps pushing for them to go on with the Indian. She's the one who puts her gun up against the other guy who was before leading them. I mean,
yeah,
she has an idea
like
what she wants, and then she takes it.
it wasn't like it was against the wishes of all the other men. In fact, all the other men are the ones who vote and decide whether or not to allow him to follow, to lead them to water.
But that's my point.
It was basically just Meek against the rest of the men and women and families. So I wouldn't necessarily call it a feminist Western.
I mean,
as our main character is Michelle Williams, because all the men in the group tend to have the exact same philosophy as her.
I mean, you have to see this as a feminist Western. I mean, whenever the men went out and they talked and they decided what they were going to do, the camera stayed back and the microphone stayed back. So we only heard it from the women's point of view. And you were almost like, turn it up. I can't understand. I don't know what's going on. But that was the whole point that Kelly Ricard was trying to make, was that she was showing this journey through the vast landscape of the American West through the eyes of the females.
But the point I'm making is that just because we're seeing it from their perspective doesn't necessarily make it a feminist film.
I think it does, and I do think Michelle Williams ends up taking over, if that's how you want to sort of define a feminist movie, is by whether or not they take power. I think she does, in a way, as far as as what she could for the time.
Well, I think that's the best way to you know, solve your disagreement there, is it just depends how you define a feminist movie. But first, to answer Brantley's question, this movie was definitely worth the price of admission. I liked it a lot, and very little of it actually had to do with, you know, whether it's a feminist Western or whether it's you know, who has power and stuff like that. A lot of it for me was just kind of this grueling journey, and the way it was portrayed, and the way that Kelly Reichardt kind of, you know, made us get right into the, you know, wagons with them. And like everything was slow about this movie because the journey they were on is slow. And I think just kind of how it brought you into this movie is really what worked for me. And if you're going to talk about whether it's a feminist Western, it does depend on how you define it. Because, yes, the movie is seen through Michelle Williams' eyes, but I kind of see what Brantley's saying, and that no one has the power in this movie, so you can't really argue that it's somebody's in control, that it's making a statement for, like, one gender or the other.
Yeah, exactly. And it looks like I might disagree with you guys a little bit, because you both seem to enjoy the film. I kind of had the same problem with Meek's Cutoff that I did with Yee-Yee, in that I feel like, you know, we're watching a very slow film that, to me, it didn't really, there was no resolution to it, and there was no real character development. It was just, these are characters, this is what they're doing. They're walking on the Oregon Trail to, you know, through the desert looking for water. And that was basically all there was. Nothing was resolved with them. It ended at a very strange point. The only difference, I think, well, one of the big differences, obviously, this is only an hour and 45 minutes as opposed to 3 hours long. But that was kind of the biggest problem I have with this film. I feel like nothing was really resolved. We have no idea what's actually happened to these characters. And I had a huge problem with that.
Well, we don't want to, I don't know how much we want to say about the ending, but I thought the ending of this movie was perfect. I would not have ended it any other way. In fact, some point in the middle of the movie, I said, I hope this movie ends this way. Because basically, without giving too much away, if, you know, if they find water, then this movie is kind of has an agenda that the, you know, the Indian that nobody likes is actually a good person. If they don't find water, then Meek is right. And it's just, if you find some middle ground, then maybe it's, you know, maybe it works out.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know quite why we're jumping to the ending, but I totally agree with you, Lee. Like, I remember thinking halfway through this movie, or even a little farther, like, how are they going to end this? And I said that exact same thing that you said. If they find water, you know, then they are, you know, they find water and maybe even the Indian dies. And if they don't find water, then we're just watching them all die. So what do we really have to, like, what kind of ending is this? And then it ended the way it did, and I was like, you know what? There's nothing else she could have done.
Well, no, I mean, see, the problem I have with that is because that I feel like is ending it like this is kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say cop out, but it's like it's not deciding anything. It's like, I'm just going to end it right here in the middle of this issue that they're going through. They've been going through the whole movie without resolving anything. I mean, we talk about in films how, like, you know, there are, you know, plots don't get wrapped up and things don't get resolved. I mean, this is huge for this movie to not resolve anything. And so you spend an hour 45 with these characters walking through a desert only to have no idea what's even going to happen with them. And I feel like that almost is like the director specifically didn't choose a side like we're talking about. But I feel like that's almost like that's possibly a worse decision than have actually decided something.
Well, I think that this movie does go somewhere, especially with the characters. And you're the one that brings up this transfer of power from Bruce Greenwood's character, Meek, to Michelle Williams. And I think that's what this movie like is more about, like how these people relate to each other and how they continue to go on and like who's making these decisions and who decides from where they are at that point what they're going to do from there. And we see that transfer of power when Meek says, like, you guys are in charge now. I've done as much as I can. And he's kind of fed up. And I think that's what's more important than whether or not they find what they're looking for. It's more like who's going to make those decisions.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know. I don't know if I...
But that's what you said. That's what you said was the big thing in this movie.
Jeremy brought up who had the power in the film. I was saying that Michelle Williams didn't have any power. Jeremy was the one who brought up saying she did have power.
I mean, well, let's get back to the point here. I mean, I totally disagree with you, Brantley, about this movie. I mean, this whole movie was a journey. I mean, this we're going to later talk about survival movies, and essentially our plot on this movie was simple. Find water. That was the idea, or else we're going to die. And Kelly Reichardt puts you right there, down there in the middle of this journey with these people. And I found myself just as almost as excited as they were to find out what was around the next corner, because maybe it could be water, maybe it couldn't. And with this ending, I don't see any other choice that she had but to do this. I mean, this movie is not about whether they find the water and not whether or not about whether there's more Indians around the corner to kill them. This movie is about the journey that these people had to take to get where they wanted to go. I mean, basically, that helped build this country, and she wanted to sit us right with them while they took this journey, and that's what she did. And like I said, I can't see another way that she could have ended this film. I think it was near perfect.
Well, look, first of all, I mean, she has an infinite amount of possibilities and ways she could have ended this movie. I don't necessarily think it was perfect. In fact,
it was one of three ways.
Those are two things, but she has an infinite amount of things that could have been in this film to end it differently. And I know you're saying that this is a movie about the journey, but just a journey does not necessarily a movie make. I mean, I could have a movie in which two guys walk through the desert for 2 hours, but if nothing happens to them and nothing is resolved and it ends...
I think that movie was made. I think it was called Jerry or something with Matt
Damon. Well, I know. That is a movie, and it didn't get very good reviews.
I didn't see that one.
But that's the point I'm making. I mean, how often do we talk about things like character development, resolving conflicts, resolving issues in films? And this film does none of it. It essentially just...
That's not true at all.
You learn a lot about the characters in this movie.
I'm not saying you don't learn a lot about them, but there's no character development. You see them for a span of 3 days in their lives, and you hardly... I don't think there's any real development with the characters. I think you just learn what their characters are like throughout those 3 days without there being any real development to them. And there certainly isn't any development to them because there's nothing that they have to come up to or strive to, and we don't see them achieve any of those things because we're just left at the ending not knowing what's happened.
I think there is character development, especially with Michelle Williams' character. I mean, everything in this movie is subtle, and yes, this movie is a slow burn, and it's one reason I didn't, like, invite people with me to go see this movie because I knew it was going to be a slow burn, and I mean, a little bored the first hour of this movie.
Yeah, there were moments when it was slow.
It's like half of it. I mean, the movie's an hour 45, and you're saying you're
Well, let me finish my point about the character development. I mean, with Michelle, but what I'm saying is everything is subtle in this movie, and Michelle Williams' character development is subtle in this movie, and I think basically her character goes from the sort of a timid, watchful, not involved with the decisions to being the decider by the end.
No, Jeremy, you can say yes all you want, but I don't agree with it. I don't think she was the decider in any way, shape, or form. She wasn't telling the group where they're going to go at the end.
She was by the end.
Really? When did she say to them, okay, this is the way we're going to go?
When they were at the tree at the very end. And
she didn't say a word.
Yes, she did. She said, we're going to keep going. We're going to stay the course. She said that. And then by that point, Meek was even asking the women, which way has your family decided to go? That's where the character development came. It was through the women all of a sudden getting more of the power and the decision of what they were doing. And I think that's why this is even more of a feminist Western than True Grit is.
I don't know, man. I don't remember any of that. I remember Meek saying, I think you're possibly making that up, because I don't remember.
I'm not making it up. I saw it like less than 12 hours ago.
Single word at the tree. I just remember her staring through it at the Native American as he continued to walk through the desert, and Meek saying, "You guys have the power now." He didn't say you, Michelle Williams, or whatever her character's name is, has the power. He was saying you all have the power, not the women have the power, not anything like that.
All right, let me solve this. Let me tell you what really happened. What Jeremy said. Okay.
If that's what happened, then that's a fault of the director for not making it clear in any way, shape, or form that the
she did say that. Apparently, she said we're going to stay the course, or something along those lines. She did say we're going to keep moving along. You missed that.
Okay, right. But that's what I'm saying, though. It's still a group decision. It's not Michelle Williams. She doesn't she wasn't the leader of the group. If anything, it was her husband.
All right, even if she's not the leader, she is gathering power. Little by little, she got more and more power. And it came to a peak when she held the gun up against Meek when he was threatening to shoot the Indian. And then he backed off. That's a transfer of power.
A transfer of power, but it's also an action that was met with the same response from her group. For instance, her husband was right with her when she did that. It wasn't as if she was acting alone or away from the group. She was acting in the same way that the group felt towards Meek at that point.
Well, I have something I can bring up that can steer us a little bit away from this argument, and probably bring us into another argument. But it will transition nicely into our segment later about theater-going experience. This movie was not shot in the normal sort of 16x9 wide frame. It was more by, 3x4, something like that?
It's 1.331, which is essentially a 4x3.
Yeah, 4x3.
Almost a square.
What do you guys think of that decision for her to shoot like that?
I couldn't wrap my head around it. I thought when we went to see this and I was seeing it in full screen that literally the projection had messed up and they put the wrong frame or were projecting it in the wrong aspect ratio. Because you're looking at this film that very much for a lot of it is just walking through the landscapes, and they're beautiful landscapes. They would look beautiful and gorgeous in a nice, you know, widescreen CinemaScope lens, and it was shot full screen, and I couldn't wrap my head around it for like most of the movie. I thought it literally was a projection issue at the theater, and it wasn't until I looked the film up on my phone afterwards that I realized that no, it was shot in full screen, and yeah. I have no idea why.
I think this is really the only idea I can come up with. I mean, it didn't need to be full screen, but I kind of have a feeling Reichardt was kind of thinking like, okay, well, I'm shooting this Western. All these Westerns always have these huge widescreen shots. Like, maybe she wanted to get away from that and thought that it would bring something new. It didn't, but yeah. I kind of feel like maybe that was what the thought process was there.
Answer to this question. I happened to listen to an NPR interview with her about 3 weeks ago, and it was on Meek's Cutoff, and that was one of the questions. And what she was trying to do, and I mean, to me it worked, but again, I had heard this interview going in. What she was trying to do was she wanted to display the vast landscape of the open West, but really the idea was she wanted it to be a little claustrophobic, that you didn't know what was right in front of you and you can't remember what was right behind you and you're just stuck in that one moment. And that's what she, I mean, whether you call that pretentious or not, I think it worked. I mean, I at least had this sense when I was with these people, like I said earlier, that I wanted to know what was just around the corner. I wanted them to find water. Hopefully something would open up to something. And her shooting like that tried to give you the sense that you were stuck where you were at that moment and you couldn't see beyond.
Well, there were moments when that worked, and that part of, and I said this earlier, part of what made this movie so good for me was the way it was shot, and like the, and like even like things as simple as like their location, when there's a hill right there and you just can't see over it. It's very good framing, everything like that. And then there's shots like in the back of the wagon looking out, which was a beautiful shot, and it just makes you feel contained and stuff. But then after that, there are so many wide shots in this movie that she can't claim that she's trying to keep it a claustrophobic feel. Like, there's too many wide shots.
If she did claim, that was her.
I know, intention. That's what I mean. It's kind of a false claim then that her plan was, because there are times when she does that, but she gets away from it too.
I don't believe, I just don't think it worked either, because I never got that feeling. I never got that claustrophobic feeling, and I completely agree with Lee that there were so many sweeping wide shots that all I was kind of frustrated throughout the movie because I was assuming the projection was wrong with it. But yeah, I agree. Like, if you can have a widescreen shot and still have, through your framing, characters at the very edge of it, not knowing what's right past it. So I don't think the full screen aspect of it worked. And I mean, maybe that's because I didn't know her intentions going in like you did, Jeremy, because you listened to the thing 3 weeks ago. You kind of knew that going in, but looking back on it, I never got a claustrophobic feeling from this movie whatsoever.
I mean, that's fair enough, and maybe I wouldn't have gotten that. I would have gotten that sense had I not heard the interview, but I wouldn't have known what it was. I wouldn't have been able to identify it. I mean, to me, I think it was effective, but I can understand.
There were moments when it worked, but it's almost like it was just, it conveniently worked with the 4:3 aspect ratio. It was almost like, you know, because she shot that, some of the shots looked better, but then she goes to a wide shot and it ultimately was ineffective. It almost kind of defeated the purpose.
Yeah, I mean, there were moments where I feel like you definitely had characters at the edge of the screen and I was like, okay, what the heck's, why is it being framed like this? But there was never that claustrophobic sense from it, and you can still do that with a widescreen lens. So,
all right. So overall, Brantley, it sounds like you really didn't enjoy your theater experience. I have to say, I didn't enjoy my theater experience. I could really relate to him because our AC broke in the theater, and I was like, oh, I don't know what they're complaining about. I got no AC in here while I'm watching them go through the desert.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a free movie ticket out of it, so not all bad. I like I said, it's a slow burn for a lot of people, and I can understand why this would. I mean, it takes a commitment to get into this movie, but I think it pays off if you can get into the pacing of this film. It pays off, and I really enjoyed it by the end.
Yeah, my favorite movie of the year so far.
Is it?
Are you serious?
Yeah, easily.
Wow.
I mean, there hasn't been that many. It would either be for me this or Source Code.
Yeah, for me it's this or Adjustment Bureau. So apparently, take your pick.
Wow, I don't know what to say from that. So we're moving on.
Without water, you won't survive more than 2 days out there. And without water, your tracks will be visible for even more. The jungle is the prison. Don't you get it? Hey, listen. Let's say you do survive the jungle and lack water. There's 6 guards posted during the day.
Yeah, that is during the day. I'm going at night.
We're going to be transitioning now into a discussion on survival movies, and this was a topic that Jeremy had suggested. So, Jeremy, why don't you take it from here?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should just, you know, it'll be a brief discussion, and basically, I think just talk about what makes them effective. I mean, for me and Lee, Meek's Cutoff was effective, and essentially all that we had was wondering if these characters were going to survive, if they're going to find water. That was the essence of the plot. They need to find water or they're going to die. And you look at other sort of survival movies, like more recently, 127 Hours, he needs to somehow figure out a way out of that cave because he's also running out of water. Life and death stakes, if they're presented like this, I mean, to me, it's very engaging cinema. What do you guys think about, you know, that general sort of theme of survival movies of life or death?
I mean, I think what survival movies have going for them is they don't have a choice, usually, but to establish their characters. And by establishing their characters and showcasing that something about them that allows them to survive, audiences then have no choice but to care about them and root for them. And
right,
then you have a built-in, like,
stakes. Movie. Stakes.
Stakes. All about the stakes.
I mean, they're huge.
Yeah, it's survival.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna bring up an odd example here, but it's kind of popped into my mind. And when you're talking about survival, you even look at bad movies, and I'm going to go with Anaconda here. I remember watching this movie, and Jeremy, I think I watched it with you, and
yeah,
we kept
were
talking.
At the drive-in.
I keep remembering us talking about how we wanted the black guy and the hot girl to live. Ice Cube and Jennifer Lopez.
I mean, how old were we? We had to have been 14, 15.
It was 1997, so whatever that was.
I'm not going to do the math.
But yeah.
13.
Even then, even a bad movie, here we are, like, rooting for these characters to survive because the black guy was cool and the girl was hot. That's all that movie needed to get us. Obviously, you look at better movies like 127 Hours, Meek's Cut Off, you have to have a little bit more than just the black guy and the hot girl. But it's basically giving you characters and something to like about them.
Right.
And boom, you have an audience interested in rooting for their characters. And then, you know, where you take it from there depends on the movie and the quality of it. But it's all kind of that same structure.
Yeah, I mean, I Jeremy loves to talk about stakes, and there's no really bigger stakes in a film than life or death. So, yeah, I enjoyed the survival film as much as the next person, and one that I kind of think back to when I thought of when Jeremy suggested it was a movie called Ravenous. I don't know if you guys had seen that.
No.
It's about like a group of people. I want to say this is like the 1800s, and it's dealing with a cannibal, which makes it kind of a little bit on the supernatural side, because the whole idea behind the film is that the cannibal he'll eat the people around him, and then he like gains their strength. So it's like trying to stop this guy who has like more strength and power than anybody else, but it's like in this, you know, remote area, so they're trying to survive against him. I mean, it's not like a great film, but it's kind of one that I liked a lot, you know, growing up. And that's kind of one that's for some reason the first one that popped into my head. But I think, you know, I enjoy it just because it's a fun movie, and because the stakes are there, it makes it worth like sitting through the film to watch it.
Yeah, I mean, stakes, life and death, they're always going to be appealing as an audience. But also, I think maybe even more with survival films that people sort of gravitate to is a loneliness factor that you see in movies, even when there's more than one character. And I think of two Tom Hanks movies. Obviously Castaway, but you got one and a half characters there, and even Apollo 13, yeah. When they, you know, they're away from their families and they could possibly never see them again. You know, I think loneliness is a very, obviously very human, emotion that, gets brought up in a lot of these survival films that I think, makes them that much more interesting.
Yeah. And I think what's so great about them is that, like, Brantley mentioned, like, this movie Ravenous. If nothing else, it's a fun movie. And that's what I think makes these movies so great, is you can have it be in the wilderness, you can have it be post-apocalyptic, in space, on an island, in, like, some remote, like, area or whatever. Regardless, that's all secondary. It's just all about what these characters are going through. And again, stakes, blah, 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 blah. But it's about, it could be anything, I guess. And we're talking about survival movies, so it's, we're saying life and death stakes, but as long as you have your characters going through something that the audience can relate to, then you have the backbone of a movie, and survival movies have that built in almost.
So to wrap this all up, speaking of survival, the Bruins have survived to the Stanley Cup Finals. Go Bees. Yep.
So moving right along, we're going to go into our next topic, which is the theater-going experience, and specifically, you know, the decline of it, and possibly, you know, will movie theaters survive? You know, will 20, 30, 50 years down the road, will we still have movie theaters that we're going to see films at? I mean, the American movie theater's been going for, you know, 100 years or more so far, but it's definitely hit some hard times recently. And I know I suggested this film just because an article that I wrote that's up on the site now, talking about, you know, the theater-going experience and how it seems a lot of times theaters don't seem to care. And this is kind of playing off of Ty Burr's article from Boston.com, in which he took a look at a lot of local theaters and found that a lot of them that used the Sony 3D projectors weren't removing the 3D lens for right. the 2D screenings. And so what that does, it causes the film to be projected 80% darker than it's supposed to be. So, you know, you're getting a 2D version of, I don't know, Thor, and, you know, the battle with the Frost Giants is suddenly so dark you can hardly even see what's going on in it. He spoke with projectionist experts in the area. Actually, I don't know if he's in the area, but anyway, he was, you know, that's who gave him the information about the Sony 3D projectors, and also just kind of pointed out that it's like, you know, it seems like the theaters just don't care. You know, I think they're in the business of getting butts in the seats, and they don't really care what the quality is, despite the fact that we as an audience are paying $12 a ticket, $17 a ticket if it's a 3D movie. I mean, it's getting kind of ridiculous.
Well, let me sort of bring a couple things together. We were just talking about, you know, survival movies, and one of the big aspects is loneliness. And I think the only reason that theaters may survive is it's a communal event that you enjoy. And I mean, at least I really enjoy going to the theater. And, you know, obviously there's audiences that can ruin a movie for you, and there's audiences that can make a movie that much better for you if you guys are all on the same wavelength. And it also gets you out of the house. It's something to do. And for me, I think there will always be theaters because of that, because people are like, hey, you want to go to a movie on a, you know, Friday night. It's something to do. But it does, I guarantee you over the next 5-10 years, we're going to see a lot more movies being released instantly to your TVs and your computer screens. It's just the way it's going to go.
Well, I think if you look at it from our perspective, of course, we are frustrated with the company we keep, and we talk all the time about, like, the, you know, the theater-going experience and how it sucks when people are talking and running around and being obnoxious, so I won't get into that too much, but you bring up, Jeremy, that people go there, it's a communal thing for people to go out and do and get out of the house, and you have to assume that even though those people are talking and annoying people like us, they are actually having a good time too.
Right.
So people are still going to the theater to have a good time, regardless of whether they're going because they want to enjoy a movie or whether they want to talk to their friends during it.
But it's that's also relevant. That goes back to Brantley's point of these theaters not caring and showing, well, yes, you know, exactly, 2D movies in with 3D projectors, and these people aren't caring also that they can't see the movie as well as it was shot. The director had intended and had shot it.
And that's what I mean. It's frustrating for us because we are going to a movie to see cinema in the form in which it's intended to be displayed, you know, on a big screen, projected correctly. Even though we, you know, it's convenient for us to watch a movie on demand, that ultimately isn't its, you know, first intended form.
Right.
So we want to get there and get that theater experience that was intended for us, but it's becoming harder and harder for us to put up with.
Yeah, and I think there will always be people like Jeremy who are always, you know, who want to go out and see the films in theaters. But I think the future of theaters is going to depend, quite honestly, and it's kind of sad, on teenagers. If teenagers are still being shipped off to the theater by their parents to see movies, then that's what's going to keep the theaters in business. Because right now, theaters, like, their profit margins are razor thin right now. They really can't afford to lose very many more customers. So if you still have, like, a small group of people, like Jeremy, who definitely want to go see the movie in the theater and stuff, but if they're not getting – if they lose, like, 10% of their, you know, audience, then theaters wouldn't even be able to stay in existence even for people like Jeremy to see the film in theaters. And I think a lot more people, with the advent of newer technology that have, you know, nice flat, big flat screen TVs and the ability to view films directly on their TV, are going to much rather stay inside to do that, just because the theater going experience is far too much of a hassle for them.
And I hope that's not the case, because I think it makes a huge difference. I don't know about you guys, but I think watching a movie in the theater on a projected screen in a dark environment with that type of surround sound makes a big difference for your film going experience. I mean, there's been a lot of movies I've seen in the theater and absolutely loved and were blown away by, and then watched it on TV or, you know, watched it on Netflix Instant or something, and it just didn't have the sort of impact it had that first time. And it makes a difference watching movies in the theater, and like Lee said, that's where they were intended to be shown, and that's where we're still shooting them for.
I mean, the frustrating thing is, and Jeremy, I agree, like, I always want to be able to go to the theater and see the movie there and stuff, but the frustrating thing is something that's been taken out of the equation as a result of, you know, bad audiences, is the audience factor, because that's also something else that once upon a time, and probably the bulk of it was before our time, but the way you relate with your audience at a movie was a big part of that experience. And, you know, it happens now with comedies, but even that's gotten annoying because people laugh at, like, the, you know, 20th Century Fox logo now when they go to a comedy because they don't know what else to do. So even that is becoming obsolete, which is a part of the movie going experience that was once a big part of it that, you know, I don't know that we ever really got the bulk of that.
Movie ticket sales have decreased year after year after year after year. I want to say, like, the past probably decade or so, just because, you know, and because of that, prices have gone up and up and up and up because studios need to try to continue to make money. Now, I'm not saying that more people going to the theater will lower tickets. That's not going to happen at all.
No.
But that's just what the studios have done to try to counteract this lack of audiences in the theaters. And if it continues to drop, you're going to see a lot more theaters who are going out of business because they can't afford to stay in it.
And the frustrating thing is it's going to be the Kendalls and the Coolidges and the Somerville theaters and stuff, not the Boston Common Lows, which suck.
I don't know. I mean, I think you're right to a degree because they're independent. They're not part of a corporation. But then again, a lot of those independent theaters like the Kendall and the Coolidge and stuff like that, they all kind of cater to the needs of the people there, I think, more than a lot of these bigger chain theaters do. I think they hire staff who know what they're doing, like, especially in terms of, like, the projectionists, you know. And I think they make for a much better theater-going experience than the multiplexes.
There's so many fewer people who care about that, though, is the problem. Like, it's like anything. Like, the good thing is the one that's harder to keep going because it's, you know, it tends to be more expensive. It tends to be, you know, harder to get for people. It's like, I mean, if we want to get real political, it's like eating healthy. It's no different, really. Like, people can't afford to eat healthy, so the people who make healthy food can't stay in business.
So, I mean, that's just, you know, that's the way things are going. But, you know, honestly, and I hope I'm right, I don't see theaters just packing up and closing up anytime soon.
Well, I mean, I don't see all of them packing up, but in the next 30 years, I could see the way that we view films completely different than the way we view them now.
Yeah. World's gonna end in a week anyway, so.
Yeah, well, that's been prophesized so many times so far this year, so.
June 9th.
And if you want to know what Lee's talking about, go to getyourfilmfix.com and check out No Tomorrow, our 48-hour film project movie.
So it's time to move on to our top five. Top five period pieces. Pretty much the hugest span of movies we could cover in a top five. So I'm sure that you guys had some criteria to narrow this down. So, Jeremy, what do you got?
As far as period pieces go, I don't have something specifically that I narrowed it down with. Just sort of a thought process of what these people kind of had to look like and what they kind of had to dress like. Maybe I could put dates on it, but I wouldn't be exactly accurate. My number five is a William Wyler film called The Little Foxes, starring Bette Davis. And I saw this movie actually recently within the last year, and it's based off of a play by Lillian Hellman. And I thought Bette Davis was amazing in this movie. She was pure evil, and the structure of this, and I talk about this in my review, just how good structurally a lot of movies that are based off of plays are, and this one's no different. It's one people should check out. It's called The Little Foxes, 1941.
Yes. I thought you'd get the world for me. You were a small-town clerk then. You haven't changed.
Well, that wasn't what you wanted.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't what I wanted. But it didn't take me long to find out my mistake. And then it was just as if I couldn't stand the sight of you. I couldn't bear to have you touch me. I thought you were such a soft, weak fool.
All right. Yeah, I just want to check it out. My next article on Get Your Film Fix likely is going to be the stage to the screen discussion. And
then you have to see makes this these movie. Work. Have to.
I'll check it out. Brantley, you still with us?
Oh, I'm still here. My criteria. This is my criteria. It had to take place in a different period than the time it was shot.
Ooh,
so
getting specific.
Blow your mind right there.
No, but that weirdly is kind of, obvious.
Well, there's also, it isn't though, because you could have like Platoon or like.
Right, and that's why I avoided those. I guess Brantley was able to phrase it in a way, yeah.
Yeah, he's smarter than you, so.
All right, well, my number five is my fun pick, and I know Lee is just, he's going to love this pick because it's like his favorite movie, but it's Army of Darkness, the third of the Evil Dead trilogy, which, of course, takes place in like medieval times.
Yeah, it's a period piece. My number five is Kid in King Arthur's Court. This kid.
Is that the way, I was just going to say, like, isn't it, what was the kid was in that?
Kid in American Pie?
Yeah, that's... Wait, no. Wasn't he the one that was in The Rookie? Or was he in both?
I think he was in both. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Rookie
of the Year. He had a monopoly on those type of movies.
Rookie of the Year, not The Rookie with Dennis Quaid.
All right. So, it was kind of like it had to be a bunch of years, 20 years, whatever. I didn't have a number for it between the time the movie was made and when the movie took place. War movies. I excluded war movies. Just to narrow it down a little bit more. And the last thing is the time period had to be relevant to the plot. It had to make a difference into what was going on. So my number five, trying to think outside the box a little bit here, is Adventureland, which takes place in the late 80s. And I wouldn't have picked this movie if it weren't for something I read with Greg Mottola, the director, talking about how the time period was so important to him for this movie. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, he wanted to make sure there were no cell phones and wanted to make sure that, you know, this was this era of, you know, college kids and what they went through in small town and basically what he went through in small town carnivals and whatnot. So Adventureland, great movie.
Yeah,
but not widely considered a period piece.
I mean, it is a period piece, but you could consider like a lot of movies, like No Country for Old Men might be on your list. I mean, these are all period pieces. So I guess maybe a subliminal criteria of mine was I didn't have any that took place in the last 100 years.
Oh wow.
So my number four is a movie I talk about a lot. So I put it at number four, and it is The Adventures of Robin Hood, starring Errol Flynn. A movie I've mentioned before, I loved as a child, and I still enjoy to this day. And it's obviously a period piece. They're all dressed in tights.
Oh, that's your favorite part.
Yes.
Errol Flynn in tights?
Yes.
All right, my number four, looking at my list, it seems more like big movies than I guess I thought it was going to be. But my number four is Gladiator from 2000. Takes place in the Roman Empire. And yeah.
Yeah, definitely a good pick. I mean, it was the Gladiator, Saving Private Ryan, Spartacus, Braveheart. Those are the reasons I avoided war movies, because I feel like that would be my top five. Maybe it's yours, apparently, but no. That's why I kind of wanted to stay away from war movies in general. Mm-hmm. All right, my number four, a movie that first time I saw it, I loved. Second time around, wasn't as crazy about it. Still very good movie, though, Amadeus.
Herr Mozart, I have come to commission work from you.
What work?
A mass for the dead.
What dead? Who is dead?
A man who deserved a requiem mass and never got one.
Who are you?
I'm only a messenger. Do you accept? You will be well paid. Do you accept? Work fast. And be sure, tell no one what you do.
That may Good show pick. Up on my list right now.
All right.
Yeah, it's my number three is Amadeus.
Good call. You
know, a movie I have to see again also, but I really, really enjoyed it when I saw it.
I remember watching that a long, long time ago, I don't know what else to say about it, so I'm moving on to my number three. My number three is a film that Lee actually just mentioned, but it is the only war movie I have on my list, and that is Saving Private Ryan. Just because I think it's probably the best war movie
ever made. Yeah, that was the toughest one to keep off my list, but just because it portrays that time period so realistically, I guess. I don't remember it.
All right. I mean, are these... I guess we're doing top five period pieces, right? Not really costume dramas?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I sort of... I guess I just subconsciously stayed with costume dramas. So my number...
That's fair enough. It's my turn, though.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you should
All right, my number three, you might kind of put in the same vein as Adventureland. But this movie definitely relies on its time period. It's Boogie Nights.
Yeah, I mean...
Good call.
Had I not gone with costume dramas, I think Boogie Nights would make my list. But, you know, I'm not changing up now. Not changing up now. As my number two is a movie we just effing watched on this very program, and that's The Innocents.
Oh, really? Interesting. Ooh.
Yes, another costume drama that, I mean, I couldn't have... sung its praises more, starring Deborah Kerr. And if you want to, we have a whole review on that on the podcast with no, what podcast? Oh, it was the Social Network podcast. You can hear a review of The Innocents.
See, when I heard you say we watched it on Get Your the Just Effing Watch It, I thought it was going to be a Man for All Seasons you were going to pick there.
No, Man for All Seasons didn't love as much as The Innocents.
Gotcha. All right, well, my number two is There Will Be Blood.
Ooh, that was the oil tycoon.
That was my favorite movie of that year. I actually liked it more than No Country for Old Men, and that comes in number two on my list.
Yeah, I mean, hard to argue there. Another PTA movie.
Right. Yep.
Makes the list twice. All right, a movie I liked more than The Innocents, a Just Effing Watch It film, A Man for All Seasons is my number two.
Really? Wow.
See, I bridged the gap right there. Bridged the gap between you two.
We don't plan these podcasts.
Not at all. All right. I guess we're already on to number ones. And being that I sort of did a different list than you guys, I did top five costume dramas. My number one is surprisingly a filmmaker we don't talk that much about on this podcast, and we should. A Mr. Stanley Kubrick, and this is Barry Lyndon. A movie, my guess is, Brantley, you probably don't love. It's also like Meek's Cut Off, a slow burn, but I am enthralled with this movie. I think it's perfectly made.
I'm not the hugest fan of that movie. Let me just tell you, Brantley, you will hate it.
Really?
Yeah, you will not
like Kubrick.
Yeah,
I do like slow burns. I think you guys are saying, like, you have this idea that I don't like slow burns. No, I like slow burns.
No, but there's
a
lot of...
I just want movies to have a...
There's a lot of nothing happening in that movie, though.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I'll have to check it out. I think it just came to Blu-ray.
And it's super long.
Yeah. All right, well, We'll move on then. My number
it's like,
one.
Forget that movie.
Yeah, my number one actually happens to be my favorite movie of all time, and that is Raging Bull. Made in 1980, takes place mostly in the 40s. So that is my number one.
It's an interesting pick. A movie that crossed my mind at one point was Goodfellas, because that kind of is based on a certain time period. But something about like it being a biopic, Raging Bull being a biopic, I guess, and Goodfellas, you could argue, is in some way, shape, or form a biopic. I steered clear of it. I don't know why, but
yeah, I'm glad I misinterpreted this list, because I can't imagine how. I mean, literally, I think it would just be my top five favorite movies for the most part, because most movies don't take place in the time they're shot, or a lot of them, a lot of the good ones. I mean, Boogie Nights, Goodfellas, Raging Bull. I mean, they would all be on my list if I hadn't misinterpreted what we were doing here.
All right, my number one. We this movie made our Get Your Film Fix top 100, but it's a movie we don't talk about a lot. Jeremy, you and I are both big fans of it, and it is The Sting. It takes place during the 1930s.
Yes.
The conning and the grifting that went on. Paul
the conning and the grifting.
Great movie. Such a great movie. I don't think it's given its due credit despite its Best Picture win.
Paul. No.
I'm out.
Call. Ace is over.
Three cowboys.
All red, queen high.
Well, thanks as me.
Don't worry about it, pal.
They wouldn't let you in here if you weren't a chump. Lombard will be joining you in a couple of minutes.
Now look here, Sean.
I've had enough of this game and quite enough of this company. Check me out, Clemens.
I guess that just leaves the three of us.
Yes, Mr. Shaw. Just leaves us three. Mr. Clayton, I think we should take a break for 5 minutes. Tempers seem to be running a little.
Oh, come on, Linneman. I'm just starting to do good.
All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We want to thank everybody for listening. As always, we encourage people to go to the site, getyourfilmfix.com, check out the articles and reviews we have up there, check out the videos we have, like the Film Students web series, as well as our 48-hour film project, No Tomorrow. And then we also encourage people to check out the Exterior Films podcast. You can find that on iTunes as well. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.